Aloha, everyone. My name is Dr. Lloyd Foreman, and today's topic is economic sanctions and statecraft. I'd like to thank all of you for joining today in this elective. Bigger crowd than I had anticipated for the second time around. As you may have guessed from the way I lecture, it's very interactive. Please feel free at any time to jump in. I will ask you questions every now and then, but feel free at any time to raise your hand or speak up and ask any questions you want or offer observations. I'm going to start off by asking you, first of all, have any of you been involved in the development or the execution of sanctions and regimes? And can I ask in what capacity?
North Korean sanctions and overseas as part of the State Department.
Fantastic. I'm going to call on you a lot. Okay. All right. So it's not something that most of you will have come into contact with on an operational basis, but you've heard about it in the news a lot lately. I mean, you can't turn on the news without sanctions on somebody, you know, whether it's Russia or North Korea or Venezuela or whatever. Sanctions are a very popular tool these days. So what I'm going to do, since most of you haven't had a lot of experience with these, is the agenda I've got is a little bit of, we were going to do introductions of everybody, but it's such a big group, we're going to hold off on that. And what we're going to do instead is move on to the reasons and types of sanctions that are out there, economic sanctions, the processes and players that are involved, a little bit on then the big question of performance, do sanctions work? We can have a few case studies we can look at, North Korea, Russia, and then on countering terrorism. And then we'll talk about how would you design a sanction if you were going to do it yourself. Does that sound pretty good? Is there anything else that anybody would add to the list of things to make sure we cover within the hour and 15 minutes that we have today? Okay, well, we'll start with this and we'll see. Like I said, jump in at any time. I'm going to ask you, what do you think the primary reasons for sanctions are? Why do people use sanctions? Just go ahead and speak up.
As an alternative to war?
An alternative to war. That's a great one. That's one of the top ones.
Political pressure.
Pressure?
Yeah. Okay. To leverage an outcome of a desired end state.
Leverage an outcome. Change behavior. That's primary motivation behind a lot of these things. Yeah, the number one reason is it's somewhere in between talking and shooting. You know, the traditional talking, just trying to talk it through diplomatically isn't working. Don't necessarily want to go to war. So it's something that's in between. And it's a little bit more of a pressure to be applied for a change behavior, but short of something like shooting at. Often used when you don't have a military or you don't want to deploy yours because it's engaged elsewhere, it's got higher priorities or other reasons, that a military solution may not be an alternative. Change of behavior we talked about. Advance a foreign policy goal or a security goal. And when I know those things are interrelated, we'll talk about some of the differences on those in a minute. And another one is the sending a signal, the demonstration of resolve. And I put that in there different from changing a behavior because oftentimes that sending the signal is domestically. You want to send a signal to your own people that you're doing something, you're taking action. And that, so you have to look at the value of this from both what it's going to do to the target country as well as how it's going to play back home in the domestic constituency. In the language of sanctions, it's talking about a sending country and a target country. The sending country being, for instance, the U.S., sanctioning the target country, North Korea, something like that. So you'll hear me use those words throughout this time. So one of the other things is, why do you think, what are sanctions used for? What kind of issues are sanctions used for? What are they, do you have any idea what they're primarily used for? Is it mostly for security reasons, like in the case of North Korea? Think of the sanctions you've heard about recently in the news.
They tend to be responses.
Be responses, yeah, they often are. To a provocative act, yes. So most people think, you know, we mostly talk about security sanctions for security reasons, but security sanctions are only a relatively small percent, or about a quarter, a little more. Economic sanctions. For economic reasons, to change a trading behavior are by and far the largest category. It's just that they're not the ones that usually get, you know, a lot of coverage in the news. But there's also other things, human rights behaviors, you know, blood diamonds and trafficking and trafficking persons, things like that. Environment are some sanctions, and then there's a smattering of other ones for very specific bilateral reasons. But generally speaking, this is what it looks like. Now, for this chart, I'm using a database called TIES. It's called the Threats and Imposition of Sanctions. So it includes times when sanctions were threatened, but not actually applied. And that's going to become important in a minute. And there's about a little over 800 data points in this data set on sanctions. But as you'll see when we talk about it, the role of a threat of a sanction has a certain value too, and not short of actually imposing one. So the types of sanctions that we have, we'll talk about some of those. So we're going to talk mostly about economic sanctions today, but there are also political sanctions. Do you know what examples of what some political sanctions could be? One of them sort of happened to us recently in Russia. Recalling ambassadors, expelling diplomats, restricting visas, even things like not having people, prohibiting them from going to the Olympics or things like that can be considered political sanctions. And so those are options as well. But what we hear mostly a lot about are the issue of economic sanctions. And there's different kinds of economic sanctions. For instance, there's trade sanctions and financial sanctions. And oftentimes an economic sanction will have elements of both in it. The trade sanction is, you can't import or export something. The financial sanctions are the ones that are largely applied to the banking sector and have to do with asset forfeiture and things like that, and moving the money. So the other way we talk about sanctions, we talk about primary sanctions and secondary sanctions. Primary sanctions are probably what you expect, and that is when the sending country sanctions the target country. But often, and the U.S. does this more than others, is you also apply a secondary sanction. I'm not only going to sanction North Korea, I'm going to sanction other people who do business with North Korea. That's a secondary sanction. And those of you who are diplomats can probably understand that secondary sanctions come with some diplomatic cost. And I don't know if you've run into those or had to deal with the cost of a secondary sanction. It's kind of like, wait a minute now, from the secondary country. We have a different way of looking at that. We have a program to support an energy supply in that country. And what you're saying, if you're going to prohibit us, you're going to sanction us because we're doing business, legitimate business in the energy industry with that company, and we want to maintain that. So the secondary sanctions becomes a very difficult political or diplomatic issue in many cases. And in fact, you'll see one in a minute. But primary and secondary sanctions. We also talk about the total sanctions, partial sanctions, and smart sanctions. They are pretty much what they sound like. The total sanction is just like completely stopping all trade. This would be like in the old days, a blockade. Now, we haven't used blockades in a long time, but that would be a total sanction. Someone brought up the other day that a blockade would actually be interpreted by many countries as an act of war, and that's one of the reasons why a blockade is often a total sanction is not implemented. Partial sanction is, of course, certain things, and that's what you hear about the most. There's a sanction against, we probably don't sanction food and medicines and humanitarian goods, but you want to sanction the things that will most affect those whose behavior you want to change. Whether it's the military, whether it's the decision makers, or the policy makers. Now, a subset of partial sanctions is smart sanctions. And this is the idea of, we're going to find that thing or set of things that will make the key decision makers change their mind, change their behavior. So you may have read that there are sanctions on luxury goods in North Korea, with the understanding that certain leaders in North Korea like certain kinds of, beverages, let's say. And so we'll say, okay, luxury goods are now going to be sanctioned and not, you cannot import those goods into North Korea. Now, do these sanctions work? We'll talk about whether sanctions work or not. What's really important in this element is the intel. So any of you who are sort of the intel side of things or analysis side of things, in order to make a smart sanction work, you've got to be pretty smart about what it is that's going to have the impact. And so if you're in that field and you can help identify those things, it's getting that sort of intel matched up with the people who are going to be designing. any of the sanctions, it's really important. You don't want to sanction something and it doesn't make a difference. Some of the things, like, you know, the luxury good ones is not being particularly effective right now because other countries will just redefine what's luxury good. All of a sudden, a $100 bottle of scotch is no longer a luxury good. You know, it has to be $200 to be $200 a bottle of the luxury good, so they can still export those $100 bottles. So those things are difficult to, they sound very smart, but it's often very difficult to sort of maintain because it's easy to find a way, it can be easy to find a way around them. So that's another option. Of course, there's the bilateral or the multilateral. Depending on which terminology you use, some people say unilateral, but that's where it's just the U.S. sanctions a country. For instance, multilateral is, of course, like the UN sanctions, or a number of countries in a coalition together decide to join together and sanction a country. Which one do you think is more effective?
Multilateral.
Which one's harder to negotiate?
Multilateral.
Yeah. Very hard. Again, it has to do a lot with the domestic constituencies in each country, and it's particularly on the trade ones in terms of what business they have with the target country, and trying to get everybody to agree that they're not going to do something is difficult. Now this one is going to sound counterintuitive. There's export sanctions and import sanctions. An export sanction means that the sending country cannot export to the target country. An import sanction means the reverse. Okay, so that might sound counterintuitive, it sounds the opposite. Now whether you are prohibiting someone from being able to import something or to sell something, which one do you think has more of an impact? Is it tougher on, and I'm just picking on North Korea because it's the latest sanctions, is it, from an economic viewpoint, limiting the things that they can import, which would be an export sanction, is that going to have more of an impact, or is limiting the things that they can export, which is considered an import sanction?
Depends on the countries they import.
It's an
import.
Import? The ones that, for them to import.
No, the import sanctions.
Import sanctions, the ones that they want to export out. Yeah.
I think it depends on how much that country depends on our trade goods, right, and how much vice versa.
It does depend. It depends on the good, it depends on the country, things like that. Generally speaking, the import sanctions, the one where you prohibit the country, the target country from selling, have a more severe effect than the other way around, the export sanctions. Because generally speaking, they can find it, the target country can find someone else to buy from. Someone's going to be willing to sell to them. Oftentimes, they only have a certain number of customers for their product, and if that's blocked, then there's not a lot of other people that want that product. And I'll show you an example. There's this database called the Atlas of Economic Complexity, which I just love. You can go in here, you can pick countries, you can pick imports and exports and partners. So for instance here, we look at North Korea, and you can see, so as you've seen recently, a lot of the sanctions are on coal and iron ore and things like that, because you can see this is the percentage of what did Korea export. So, you know, putting a sanction on cars wouldn't be a huge, or crustaceans wouldn't have a huge impact on the economy.
Women's overcoats,
though. But if you want to hit something, you want to hit something major, right? So this gets more interesting when you look at, okay, who did they export to? What do you think?
China.
Let's take a look. By how much? There you go. So this is why, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on why China has to be a player in a sanction, because the rest of the world here, if you got Chile or, you know, Pakistan or Turkey here to be involved, that's fine, but, you know, as long as this is the big player here in the field. And you can look at this also. This is a great database. You can go in there and look at imports as well. Who do they import from? And guess what? No surprise.
Please.
And I've added the links for all of these things are on the slides that are in the drives, and they'll be on the APCSS link for you, so you can access all these databases. But this is a great one, because if you're going to design a sanction, obviously you want to pick someone that's going to hurt one way or the other, and saying you need to have the partners involved that are going to be important, or else you have this ability to find alternatives. And wonderful luck with this one loading right now. But you can imagine what it is. Who do they import from? China. And you can also look at what they import. Well, we'll come back to that later when it's open. I'm sure it'll eventually load up. Okay. So export imports. All right. Now let's go back. Yes, question. Go ahead.
We've gone to the point where we're actually targeting individuals, both political and business.
Right.
Do they fall into one of these categories?
So a lot of those individuals and businesses are going to be largely on the financial instruments rather than the trade instruments, because it's going to be asset forfeitures and freezes and things like that. But you know, I'm looking at the list. In the U.S. right now, we have about 5,500 names on that list of businesses or individuals from around the world that are on the Office of Foreign Assets Control list. And a lot of that is about moving their money rather than the products per se. Some of it's on products, but they would be related to sort of core products, again, that are important. Either important because of they will affect the economy, or important because they're a product that's useful in the creation of weapons of mass destruction or something like that. So there will be a link between what it is that company is doing. If it isn't just a strict financial sanction on an asset forfeiture or a freeze, then it'll be because there's a commodity link on one way or the other. And we can show you that list too, how you can look at that list. But yeah, you'll see a lot of it is individuals. So the reasons economic sanctions work, you all remember the lecture from the other day, I hope, and the definition of economics as being the science of scarcity and choice. So what sanctions are all about is forcing a scarcity and hoping that in turn that forces someone to make a new choice. And the choice is the change in the behavior to something that we want to see. So different kinds of tools that are in the toolkit for economic sanctions. I mentioned blockade, suspend trade, arms embargoes, that's a form of a sanction. Now travel bans, you might say, well, that's a political sanction, that's not an economic one. But travel bans do have a large economic impact, obviously, not just your tourism industry, but also business people and others who want to travel as well. The asset freezes or forfeitures, suspending aid, that's another one. Those people in the class who are from USAID know that oftentimes it's easy to use this as a tool to try to turn it on and turn it off so that we can send a signal as well, suspending foreign aid. Investment restrictions, same sort of thing. Non-tariff trade barriers and tariffs can be used as part of a sanction. They're usually part of the sanction itself is put out there, and then this is how you enforce it, is through the tariff or the non-tariff trade barrier. And quotas. Quotas are another way. And you'll see quotas in a number of the sanctions that are currently out there in terms of nothing additional to what is already being done, and that's the applied quota. So I want to show this just briefly, and I've got the links for it. For those of you who like game theory versus decision theory, decision theory would basically say your target has two choices. You can violate or comply. And the choice for the sender then is pretty straightforward. If they violate, you sanction them. If they comply with what you want to do, you don't sanction them. That's kind of it. And the cost, if you did all the formulas and the calculations, you would sort of look at if one cost is bigger than the other, that's how they will decide to play. And in this case, in decision theory, the strategy depends on the fiat of the player. The player will decide what's going to cost me more. And then they'll act accordingly. If you apply game theory to this, and again, I won't go through all of it, but game theory will show you that there are actually other options and there's costs to both the sender and the receiver. And when you work this out and you look at if this is greater than that elements, what you'll find out is actually the strategy depends on the payoff to the opponent. So you've got to be thinking through what the opponent is going to get. It's less about you, it's a little bit more about the opponent. I won't spend a lot of time on this because it gets into the weeds very quickly, but for those who like that, and there have been people who are very fascinated about that, here's a link to an article that will give you some information and talk you through all of this. And I know a number of people in prior classes have been big into game theory, so I highly recommend that. This is a fascinating activity to apply that to and help you as you think about designing this action. Okay, the big three. Between the EU, the UN, and the United States, we impose most of the sanctions in the world. Other countries do somewhat, but one of the big rules of sanctions is the sender's got to be bigger than the target, generally speaking. You know, if the U.S. sanctions somebody, that's a big deal. If Nauru, the nation of Nauru, tried to sanction someone, you know, not so much. Sorry, Nauru. So these are the big three. Now, in the case of the United States, sanctions can be imposed either by the president directly through executive order, and or through the Treasury or through Congress. They're managed primarily by Treasury. A lot of other agencies aren't involved, but Treasury primarily manages through the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And they have a, let me show you quickly the websites here. Let's see. So you can go in here, you can see sort of, besides the list of these 5,500 names of individuals and organizations, you can go in here and find the active sanctions programs, and you can click on these, and it'll give you the various details of the different kinds of sanctions that are currently in play in the U.S. And then these are the ones that are no longer are inactive now. We've lifted the sanctions on Myanmar and on Ivory Coast. So you can take a look at that if you want. You can talk about more of the details. Now, in the case of the 26 current cases. And you say, I've heard more than 26 in just the last week alone. I mean, I keep hearing sanctions all the time. A lot of the sanctions you hear about are existing sanction regimes, and then they just added more to it. They've added more names or more products or different things to the existing sanction regime. Now, the EU, they don't call them sanctions. They call them restrictive measures. In the case of the EU, you have to have unanimous consent of the members of the council. So they've had a little over, they've had 32 cases since the EU began, so that's getting unanimous consent on something is not easy, even in the EU, especially in the EU. And so they have cases. And I'll show you, for them, you can go in, they also have a list here of their restrictive measures, and you can go to their measures in force, you can click on any of these. And one of the interesting ones I'll mention in a minute is one of the sanctions they have is against us, against the United States. And then the third one is United Nations. So this is a majority vote without a veto of the Security Council, is what it takes. So once the sanction is put into place, then they create a committee, which is chaired by one of those member countries that is of the Security Council, but not one of the five that have the veto power. They create a sanctions committee, and they've had 26 cases so far. So the big deal about a lot of the sanctions is that they're not vetoed, and that's probably the biggest message out of the latest sanctions on North Korea by the UN was that it wasn't vetoed. Whether or not the sanction has a lot of teeth in it, whether or not it's going to have impact, it's more the political message that it wasn't vetoed this time around. It has been, they have been in the past, attempts have been in the past. Okay, so here, this is a chart I was looking for. There we go. So these are the sanctions. You can see that the U.S., besides having some that are based on nations, also have some that are themes, and the themes can apply across anybody. So we've got sanctions that apply to counter-narcotics and cyber, non-proliferation, the diamond trade, and then also transnational criminal organizations, including trafficking in persons. We also have these that are country-specific, overlapping with the UN, and then we have the European Union has some that we don't have, as you can see, including the sanction against us. They still have the sanctions against Myanmar in place. Now, the EU is more likely to sanction on human rights cases, and that's one of the reasons why. You see some of those things are still on there. Now, anybody know why the EU sanctions us?
Death penalty?
No. It's not a human rights issue.
It's
something we mentioned earlier. Our use of secondary sanctions. They are sanctioning our sanctions. Okay? They don't like the fact that we sanction secondary sanctions because a lot of that impact will be on members of the EU. You know, France may have, like I said, an energy program or a pipeline program. Germany has an investment. So that use of secondary sanctions, they don't like that, so they sanction the sanctions. And again, you can go to that site I showed you, again, the links are on the slides, and you can actually read the language of the sanction, but it's a sanction on a sanction. Any questions on those?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
EU is not sanctioning Venezuela.
EU right now is?
I'm just thinking, you know, if you're talking human rights, if that's a hot button, maybe just not, they haven't gotten to it.
Not yet. I mean, EU's kind of, things are kind of.
And Cuba.
So one of the other things about the sanctions in general, and we've seen it particularly with the U.S., is there's been a little bit of sanctions fatigue lately, even though you still see them all the time in the news. Whereas it used to take just a few days, in the case, for instance, in our case, it would take, you know, less than a week after after North Korea shot off a missile or something, that we'd have a sanction out there. Now it's taking longer and longer to do that. And so if something happened just recently, and Venezuela's been brewing for a while, but it's just relatively recent that, you know, we've gone that route.
Particularly, 2016 also,
yeah, so particularly in the multilateral ones. Yeah, this is the end of last year. I'm updating it for then. Particularly in the multilateral ones, it takes longer to develop the sanctions, particularly when they need unanimous consent in the case of the EU to do that. So you can see quite a bit of commonality on some of them, largely around the issues of terrorism and countering violent extremism. Are the ones that sort of have that common UN, EU, US overlap there. Okay, questions, thoughts? Anybody missing? Any countries on there missing that you think, how come they're not sanctioned?
Why is Haiti sanctioned?
Why is Haiti sanctioned by the EU? I'd have to look that one up, to tell you the truth. It's I'm pretty sure it's a human rights one, but I'd have to look and see. But we can do that real quickly. Let's go, Haiti. Contrast the UN Security Council resolution. Now I'd have to look at all those Security Council resolutions, but we can see what it is there. But I'd have to go look that up in a little bit more detail, but I'm pretty sure a lot of these have to do with, most of the ones on that site have to do with human rights or governance issues. But I can double check on that and let you know afterwards.
And this could be on certain persons, right? Because I think the former Yugoslavia sanctions are on particular people.
Right, yeah. Now the people ones can be other, the people ones are, that's one of the tools within this is, you'll say we're going to sanction former Yugoslavia, and then you say, who are we sanctioning within the country? These are not total blockades. They'll say it in there, and then there'll be this whole list of, you know, 140 pages of people who are listed. And if you are a business, for instance, doing business with any of these organizations or individuals, you have to check those lists. I was a regional director for Microsoft in Asia for 5 years. And any time that we even wanted to give money, you know, philanthropically to someone, we have to check all of these lists from the EU, from, you know, from the US, from others. It's a lot of different lists to make sure that we're not violating any sanction that's out there. Now, if there are ways within, for instance, within the US through Treasury to apply for an exception to a sanction, if there's something that you are providing that, for instance, is essential to humanitarian response or something like that that could be categorized and fall within the sanctioned goods as well, you can apply for a license outside of a sanction. And there's a whole process for doing that. And it's all publicly available in terms of what's there. But yeah, it's largely, a lot of these are largely individuals or big product categories. Good point. So let's see. All right, do sanctions work? This is the key part. This is what everybody wants to talk about. Do sanctions work? What do you think?
Sometimes.
How much is time? Guess?
50%.
It's a subjective answer.
It's
okay.
It probably depends on what you're trying to accomplish, because like in the case of Russia, You know, have you managed to change policy yet? No, and it might not come anytime soon. And yet the mere fact that the Russians were pushing so hard to have the sanctions lifted, with the travel bans, the sanctions, and other things that we've imposed, like, definitely it is imposing a cost. And since those sanctions were levied primarily as a form of punishment, I mean, are they working? Sort of no, but at the same time, like, if you're punishing them for bad actions and they're not changing those actions.
You have to conclude that the sanctions on Iran
Iran is considered one of the more successful cases.
So kind of what they're getting at, what do we constitute war?
Okay, that's a good question. And there's been a number of different ways that people have looked at this. One of the best ongoing analysis of sanctions is done by the Peterson Institute for International Economics based out of Washington, D.C., and they track sanctions. And I'm going to go back to that TIES database, the one on threats and impositions of sanctions, but they both come about the same conclusion, that sanctions work in about a third of the time. Target acquiesces. And now work is, let's say there are five things you want the country to do. They consider it a success if the country does one of the five. Okay, so even if you only do one of the five, that considers a success. And if you count that as a success and count them all up, you get around a third of the time that it's successful. And it's about a third of the time the senator capitulates, just gives up whether there's a stalemate or there's a negotiated settlement somewhere in there. So, yeah, about a third. Now, why do people still do them? Well, it's still a tool. I mean, and the third is still better than not having tried at all. Now, here's an interesting question about this. We'll look at some of the characters. We'll change the question a bit. When do sanctions work? So, do they work better if the target is a friend or an enemy?
Friend.
Your friends want to stay your friends. Your enemies don't give a leap. But your friends want to stay your friends, so they will make changes in order to stay your friends. So they work better with your friends. Multilateral, unilateral, we talked about that earlier. Multilateral, generally speaking. Targeted or traditional. So targeted is the sort of the smart sanction, the kind of the partial type of thing, versus the traditional, which is sort of the broader sanction. About the same. You would think that the targeted ones would be a higher success rate. So far, not indicating a particularly higher success rate than targeted ones versus a more general, hit the entire iron ore and coal business.
But is that taking into account other factors, like, for example, just preserving better relations with the people rather than just the host government or things like that? When you say that the targeted traditional are roughly the same?
Because one of the things is that the targeted ones, let's say the targeted ones are trying to hit the leaders, and you think that maybe the masses will then rise up and be more appreciative of what you're trying to do to hit the evil leaders. Well, oftentimes the evil leaders can use this as a way to rally everybody back. Oh, it's the evil Americans or the evil EU or something else that is causing this pain to us.
Yeah.
It's not their actions, it's somebody else. So.
No doubt. I mean, I'm just thinking of cases like, medicine was the example that shows before. Like, if you do still, allow the shipment and movement of certain goods to a country, does anybody look at sort of a broader outcome or a more holistic outcome and say, like, yes, targeted is better in terms of broad outcomes rather than just specifically do they achieve capitulation?
So far, that would be a great dissertation topic. I think if you wanted to pursue that, I think it would be great. So far, no. I mean, there's not a lot that indicates that. Of course, it's often very hard. The more targeted you get, of course, it's also hard to link the causality of it as well. There's other things. So for instance, sanctions get rubbed against Russia. Do sanctions against Russia have a big impact? No, the biggest thing that's had an economic impact on Russia lately is the drop of oil price. So how much has Russia changed a behavior or not changed a behavior because of an economic sanction? Or are they doing things because of a broader economic issue that has gotten in the way? So it's really hard you know, especially as you get more targeted, is to find, to make that causality link on it. But generally speaking, the data so far is kind of somewhat equal. I actually sort of gave you the preview of the answer to the next one. Do sanctions, are they better when they're a carrot or a stick? And the carrot meaning, this is how it's often used, and we've done this frequently, is you offer to lift a sanction that you have in order to get another action. So for instance, we may lift a human rights sanction we have. We'll make the case that in the case of terrorism, we will look the other way, we will lift the sanction on human rights because we want a behavior to join us on a fight of terror. Okay. And so does that lifting of a sanction, is that more powerful than the actual stick, the punishment of imposing the sanction? Which one is better?
Probably the rule.
Well, I put the plus up because the thing is, they actually work best together. I mean, the combination of putting them together. The carrots are incredibly powerful. And of course, it all depends, like all sanctions do, on have you made it hurt enough? You know, is it something that they heard about? Or if time has gone on and people have learned how to get around it or adapt to it or everything else, it doesn't matter if you lift it. But oftentimes, lifting a sanction, particularly on a traded good, is in exchange for a behavior, for instance, join us in the fight on terror, is something that has had, actually, that sort of inducement effect has had more of a positive impact than the actual sanction itself.
That was one thing that we debated internally a lot when it came to Russia sanctions, because a lot of people are of the mindset that Putin is looking for an off-ramp, and other people are saying that he doesn't really care. The carrot sometimes gives people a way to save face and look like they're winning and not have to, you know, stick out against opponents for a matter of pride.
Yeah.
That has worked in the Iran case as well.
Pardon?
It's worked in the Iran case.
In Iran case as well.
Combination.
And that's one of the key things about sanctions is sanctions alone seldom work. I mean, even the ones where we show success, it's got to be done in a package of negotiations, a package of, you know, potential threat or actual execution of a military alternative. I mean, it's when diplomats say all options are on the table, all options are on the table, and this is one of the options.
So when you talk about the carrots, you call them rewards, but they're not really rewards, they're removal of punishment.
Removal of punishment, yeah. Yeah, look at it. You know, someone the other day said, "Well, I think parenting in this case, you know, how I deal with my kids, and is it really a reward or removal of punishment?"
Yeah,
you know?
Well, because in behavioral psychology, they're separated because they have a different effect on
them. Definitely. Yeah, so that's a good point. But that's one of the ways, and the combination works well together. Okay, here's a few other ones. When you're asking for a comprehensive series of actions for the target to do, or are you asking for relatively modest? Yeah, modest. You know, if you try to ask people to do a lot of things, there's too many moving parts. It's a complex system. It's a complex adaptive system at that. And so if you have a couple things, one of the things that is fairly universal in the research is that the closer what you're asking them to do is a core value of that country or that target, you're not going to affect it with a sanction. I mean, regime change. Yeah, that's rather core to a regime is staying in power. And if what you want from an economic sanction is for them to step down, generally not happen. There's just, you know, too many other consequences of what you take to make that happen that would not be acceptable. So the closer you get to the core value of the target, you're going to have a harder time having an impact. Okay, we talked about this one, restricting the exports of the country has more power than, generally speaking, than restricting the imports. Okay, here's a good one. What works better? To hit a mark from the start, make the sanction as tough as possible from the start, here it is, you know, close to a blockade, or turn the screw a little bit, if it doesn't work, make it a little bit harder, make it a little harder. Which one is more effective? Interesting mix here.
Okay. Depends on the relationship with the other party. So
this one's fairly the research is fairly consistent on this one. Hitting hard from the start would has much more of an impact. Being hard to start. Now, here's the deal. Who's involved in setting these things up? Generally diplomats. Do diplomats have to hit hard from the start?
No.
No, it's the nature of diplomats to turn this through. I got all you folks in here who work with those agencies going, ah. Oh. You want to do that like a little bit, and a little bit more, and a little bit more? So it's not in the nature of the people who are involved in these to do that. You know, it's, let's just see if we can get by with this, if that'll make that, make them change. But if you really wanted to, you would not only hit hard from the start, but you would hit at a volume that would, you know, really get their attention. Something that's really been hit them hard. But in reality, what happens, turn the screw, is almost universal. Seldom do you see the hit them hard from the start. Okay, here's a good one. What is more powerful, the threat of the sanction or the actual sanction? Oh, everything's contextual, yeah.
I'd say a hit them hard is better than trying to screw up, say, actual sanctions.
Actual sanctions?
That's a true question. Mm.
It's about even. According to this database, I mean, you look at it here. Here's the target acquiesces. It's just a threat. When it's just at the threat stage, it doesn't go all the way to a sanction. 19.7. At the sanction stage, 70.8. Okay? Senate official aids? Again, this is a data set of about 800 cases. And
you have to get a country that's known to actually impose sanctions.
Oh, yeah.
You just always threaten them.
Oh, no, no, you cannot. I won't. I mean, you've got to be, you've done it, you know, on occasion actually done it and made it stick and had penalties that were, that the cost was equal to, you know, was painful enough. Yeah, you have to do that. You can't just cry wolf or nobody's going to take the threat seriously anymore. But the point of it is that a credible threat can sometimes be as powerful as actually going through with it. Now, a lot of this then requires you to have a very consistent messaging. And that's one of the things, whether it's with your Congress and your president, or whoever it is that's involved in making it, you've got to have some consistent messaging about the threat of doing it. Because if the, you know, the president threatens and a Congress says, not so much, you know, or vice versa, it's not going to take them seriously. But this is a interesting set of slides on the effectiveness of just making a credible threat. Okay, so there's consequences to make sanctions, of course. And that's one of the reasons oftentimes they're not imposed. So what are some of the key consequences that you are concerned about or that you've heard about? I mean, if you impose a sanction, what's a consequence to either the target country or to the sender itself?
Hurts the people.
The humanitarian impacts, yeah. It can hurt the people. That's a big one.
Hurts economic partners.
Hurts your economic partners, including your own domestic industry as well. Yeah, hurts your partners. There's a number of them. There's a whole bunch of them. Innocence can get hurt. That's the number one that people worry about. You hurt your businesses. This business about deglobalization, it's a big deal if you work in a multinational corporation. That's the MNC here, the multinational corporation. I work for Microsoft. Microsoft considers itself a global company. It's got subsidiaries in almost every country. But it's an American firm. So when it has to apply by American law, and so it makes you more of an American company when you're competing in a market and you are bound by American restrictions on, for instance, trading with a country, and someone else isn't. So it gets you, it, in some ways, it has this deglobalizing effect. Again, we talked earlier about the resentment of the sanctions of the sender. You can get, and many people, who's very successful at this right now about rallying, making the sending country, the sender countries, the enemy, the target, in terms of the literature and the media that's out there?
Russia.
Yeah. Putin is very popular. Is very successful with this in making it, you know, the sanctions are the fault of the problems of the imposed by the sending countries. Reducing offshore assets can strengthen the leader's hand. So let's say you are a despot and you people in your country, you know, are kind of hedging their bets. They're putting some of their money offshore in other countries. They don't trust you. And so they're putting their money offshore. Now that money's frozen, people aren't going to put money offshore if they can't get access to it. So they have to keep it at home. Even though it's risky, they're going to keep it at home. Well, if they keep it at home, then you as the leader at home have more to say about that. So you can actually strengthen in some ways the leader's hand in that regard. And it's not just, you know, a lot of people put money in the U.S. A lot of people who don't like the U.S. put money in the U.S. because it's a safe place to invest. But we can see it in other places too. A lot of people in Southeast Asia put money in Singapore. You know, Singapore banks seem to be a little more, people trust them more, so they put more money in the Singapore banks. But if Singapore froze their assets and they couldn't get to them, then you know, people would keep them at home as well. And then, again, we have this issue of perhaps strengthening the hand of the leader unintentionally. Our diplomats in the room can talk to the diplomatic effects of the sanctions, particularly the secondary sanctions. You know, this is one that's, yes, we understand why you want to go after terrorism, but you don't need to go after my domestic business, or you're hurting me in the process, to the point where, you know, the EU sanctions us on our sanctions. But that, anybody in the room who has that kind of background, feel free to give examples on that.
One rather odd example is the fact that we've been sanctioning Russian arms sales, but then there are also a lot of Russian arms in Afghanistan historically. So we have really complicated interagency discussion process about whether our own sanctions should apply to what we do to support the military, the indigenous and developing military.
And it's harder and harder these days, particularly on trade sanctions on products, with the increasing globalization. And you know, when you looked at how something is made these days, where all the parts come, you know, you can say, like, I'm going to sanction, you know, we can't have automobiles from Korea. But it turns out that Korean automobiles, 75% made with parts from someplace else, and including the U.S. You know, so you've got to think about all those effects of. Sanctions in a way is, am I actually going to end up hurting myself somehow in this process? And again, those people who are analysts and stuff, this is really important to be able to think through second, third order, and on and beyond on those elements. And one of the other big consequences, of course, is retaliation. You know, so you sanction me, I'll sanction you, and we can go back and forth, and it can just make things quite difficult in terms of backing off from that and try to save face or return to a normal discussion if we start throwing sanctions at each other. But nonetheless, people still find sanctions to be valuable. In fact, I'll give you a couple of best practices, and then we'll talk about if you were to design a sanction. So based on a lot of those observations, I went through a lot of literature, and these are some of the common themes that come up about best practices and sanctions. And we talked about most of these already. Slam the hammer, don't turn the screw. Consider the consequences. The well-rounded approach means, again, the sanctions not on their own. You can't stand alone. They've got to be in a package that includes all the options on the table, from talking to potentially funding and everything in between. That's the package that you'll get together. So, and oftentimes, and sanctions with inducements too. I mean, there's you can turn off aid, but you could also perhaps offer. Because that gets to the next point. So, yeah. The real power of sanctions is not what happens when you oppose them, but when you lift them. Think about that. So you got them to change behavior, and now you're going to lift it. Are they going to stay with that changed behavior, or are they going to revert to where they were before? That's a really important statement, is what happens when you, not when you impose them, but when you lift them. So you think of places where we've recently lifted sanctions, like Myanmar. So what's going to happen? You know, are the things that we, you know, is there going to be a return to the military rule, the things that our sanctions were imposed for? And you've got to watch that. And then to what extent do you want to have inducements, carrots, to add to help them stay on that path of the changed behavior versus reverting to what was there before? That's a really important statement. Okay, some case studies, just a little bit. North Korea. Latest round of sanctions that came up. We're going to export of coal, iron, and iron ore. And you saw why from that chart, in terms of that's the big chunk of the economy, the extent there is an economy. They're going to the work authorizations. There's a lot of North Korean nationals that work in other countries that have these work authorizations. Mongolians, some of the Malaysians, some other countries have them. New joint ventures. And then a travel ban and assets freeze. So now, these are the latest round of sanctions. Are they going to work?
Depends on how well China.
Depends a lot on China, yeah. Depends on China. Here's the other thing that sort of, I mean, the value of this, I argue that the value of this set of sanctions isn't the sanctions themselves, because look at, here's the other thing in here. They're not stopping things completely. They're just stopping any more. No, you can't increase this. You know, you can't, less of, it's not a complete ban. It isn't a slam the hammer. It's like, so there's still work authorizations. It's just, they can't increase the number of work authorizations. And there's still joint ventures. That's just not new joint ventures or additional investments or additional, you know, things like that. So it isn't like it's going to shut the door right away. But again, the value of this set of sanctions is the fact that it wasn't vetoed in the UN Security Council. And it's more about the political message that was sent by who joined on board this time and didn't veto the sanction. But the sanctions themselves, you know, North Korea's been rolling along and has produced what it's produced with the existing level of investment and work permits and everything else. So it's not necessarily going to stop that. Yeah.
Isn't the part saying imposing a full ban on the export? That's not different, or
that is. But the thing is, the how much of it has already been banned already? The full ban. The difference from what was there, the marginal difference isn't huge. Yeah,
so. But isn't what's big about that the fact that China was bought on with that?
Exactly. No, that's the point.
So that's what makes
that powerful. That's the point, is that China was on board. Yeah. Now, enforcement of it is going to be another issue, and compliance, but it was another comment.
Is there anybody studying to maybe it's a micro-sanction in South Korea and the Park Administration after the 2015 escalation? They shut down the Kaesong Industrial Complex. You know, maybe it affected 60,000 people for jobs out there. Study on that.
So actually, I'm still finishing his book, but Marcus Nolan and Stefan Hager have just come out with Our Targets, this book on sanctions inducements in the case of North Korea. And I'll put it back in the library as soon as I'm done with it, but it's, you can actually go online under the Peterson Institute where Marcus works, and there's a couple of videos of him talking about the book and about the study that they had there, and you'll find an analysis in there. He talks a bit about that in here as well, and so you can look at that online in terms of that. A lot of the investments and stuff in North Korea are all either state-owned enterprises or owned by the military and things like that. So, you know, are they hitting the right places and are they hitting hard enough, or are they just moving around is the question to look at. But yeah, I would highly encourage either the book or looking online and watching some of the videos on that, of his recent announcements about the book.
Yeah, we had Marcus for a roundtable at PACOM headquarters, and he's here with the East West Center right now. He made the argument there, at least, that North Korea hasn't been very responsive and it hasn't been very successful on the mission. And he seemed rather skeptical about the additional sanctions.
Yeah, again, the sanctions themselves, and I share that concern, and I heard Marcus recently too, and I share that concern that I don't think the sanctions themselves are going to create that much of a difference, but it's the political signal that was sent,
sure.
That maybe one of their allies is backing down a bit, or is not going to be there behind them as much as they thought. We'll see how they go. Yes.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was thinking about, maybe this is not appropriate. Maybe we are you having a question answer?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I wonder if you can comment on not necessarily the formal sanctions, but for instance, you know, we stop foreign aid when there's a coup, military coup. Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember Equatorial Guinea, Thailand. We even know stuff. What effect is that? Has that been on? And a lot of colleagues here probably run into a situation where, you know, they can't train military professionals under certain sorts of
circumstances. Sure. I mean, it's frozen.
So I wonder, can you comment on the effectiveness of that? I think about Egypt, for instance.
Right.
We kind of said, oh, there's a coup, but okay.
Well, again, and I'm going to use the answer that you guys have given me when I've asked you questions as well. It's contextual. And it is. It depends. I mean, oftentimes, U.S. foreign aid is a relatively small part of the economy, or relatively smart, even a small part of the donor system. So cutting off our aid is a symbolic measure, and as you know, it takes a while to cut it off. It isn't like tomorrow it's gone. But so it's going to depend. I mean, if it was something that, that had a big impact. But as you know, most of our aid budget is in relatively small pieces in the countries, at least in this part of the world. And turning it off would hurt certain projects and certain sectors, but it wouldn't bring grinding to a halt and may not bring about the kind of change we want if the change is something that's as big as a coup. And that kind of a change is going to take something that's got real cost. Rule number one, I mean, target's got to be bigger than sender. And if the target, I mean, the U.S. may be big, but if it's the, just our aid that we're talking about, and the sender's economy is much bigger, not so much.
Answering his question there, in some instances, like Thailand recently, us cutting off foreign military sales and some of the grant programs doesn't appear to have any real impact on their behavior. But when the same thing was done to Egypt and Bahrain, we started to hear it at the senior defense, and then it would make its way up. So it's like you said, it's a mix. But we still hear when it really affects them, we hear about it. And it's when I say we, Department of Defense, certainly, I'm sure State Department hears from their channels as well.
Yeah, it's a matter of numbers. It's a numbers game, largely, on those things. I'm pretty good on the aid of the aids and arms sales and things like that. Let's take another example, just quickly. I've talked to some ones that are in the news recently. Russia, the sanctions on Russia are actually existing sanctions. They just extended them and added a few more elements to them. But the main element in the latest one is adding congressional consent so that the president cannot change the sanctions without the congressional consent. Lots of targets in Russia's sanctions. We got, you know, it's over Syria, it's over cybersecurity, it's over human rights, it's over a lot of different things. There's a lot of things covered in the existing Russia sanctions. There's more than a dozen different tools that are employed that are mentioned in the latest sanctions to be used, you know, from both the financial and the trade. And then it also obliges the president to use a number of them. So the big thing on this one here, I'll point out, is this issue. This is the one that's causing this grief with our European partners, because this is a secondary sanction. The sanctioning those who invest in Russia's energy export pipelines, and those investors are largely like the French and the Germans right now, and they're not really happy about that in terms of the energy export pipelines. But this is, if you want to see a sanction that's sort of got soup to nuts, it's got everything in it, this is the ones against Russia, a pretty good one right now. We've heard about it because of cyber, but it's a little bit of everything. Okay, these are the countries who have sanctioned Russia recently. Okay, another use of sanctions, a growing one, is the use of sanctions to counter terrorism. Well, there's a couple of different points to think about then when you're using sanctions to counter terrorism. And that, first of all, most of the assets of people who are terrorists aren't using an ATM card in Western Union and things like that. They're using other forms of finance to move the money around. So it's really hard to freeze assets. That sort of limits your ability, at least on that score, to do anything with it. The other interesting thing is that terrorist activities are, compared to, for instance, the narcotics trade, it's a relatively low budget operation. And right now, with all the work, but the kind of intel, the kind of work you have to do to track, for instance, the financing for terrorism is the same that you would do on counter-narcotics and any other transnational crime. And it's high, that's a lot of work. It's high levels of work. The estimates are that with all the work that's been done on counter-narcotics, you may be getting 1%. You're probably getting 1% of the trade through sanctions, through the sanctions that are, and the asset forfeitures and freezes. 1% of the narcotics trade is being affected by sanctions. So even if you were 10 times more successful at terrorism and you got 10% of it, you still got 90% of it's getting through there. So you just gonna have to think about the trade-offs of it. Not saying not to do it, but just don't think that sanctions are going to be the be-all and end-all, the way to answer to fight terrorism. The other thing is, because it's a low-budget situation, you get one very rich financier, and they can undercut your efforts, finance it. And a lot of the secondary sanctions we have in place now are because of terrorism, you know, so there's a lot of that, you have that diplomatic cost on that. Generally speaking, though, people are on board if it's about terrorism, you know, much more so than a trade or human rights or other issues. And then this is the one where the idea of lifting sanctions in return for supporting this issue might have a higher yield. You know, we looked the other way on some issues with Pakistan right after 9/11, and said, okay, we'll stop those looking at those issues. We'll look the other way on those because this is the bigger battle to fight right now. If you join us on this, that's what we'll do. And that kind of action might have a higher reward than having imposed another sanction on Pakistan to make them join us. That's the sort of thing. Yeah. So those are the kind of points about in terms of counterterrorism. Lots of sanctions on that field. Most of the names on the OFAC list, I would say, are about terrorist financing. You need to go through all that. Those of us who were in AID at the time of 9/11 remember having to go through all of our grants and everything else and look at and double check everything to see if any of those NGOs or other groups we were supporting were actually front organizations for terrorist groups. And that meant going through not just the names of the organization, you know, is the Palestine Dental Association really a dental association or not, but also the individuals who were on the boards and key officers of those organizations. And so there's a lot of that sort of work goes into it in terms of the counterterrorism, both at the individual name level and the organizational level. Okay, let's talk about designing a sanction. We got 10 minutes left or so. These are the kind of things that you would, that generally speaking, you would think about if you're going to design a sanction. And if you think you still would you still use them? Would you still have to keep them in your toolkit of things that you would do? Yeah, I mean, they still work a third of the, even if they only work a third of the time, that's still something, you know, if you can design it with a relatively low cost. So these are some of the points up here, and I'll just let you read them, and let me know if there's anything that you want to debate or you have questions about. I'd say one of the ones that I think people, I mean, a lot of governments ignore is the bullet over here on considering the role of civil society, the media, and domestic support. The target country will often look at that, and that's how they rally the troops to be like, oh, those evil sending countries, you know, that impose a sanction on us. But oftentimes the sending country doesn't think about that, about how can they engage, you know, civil society, the media, and domestic support. And that's one of the reasons why the North Korea sanctions, people are pretty pessimistic about them. It's not like the local people are going to rise up against the awful leaders and they get the sanction lift because they don't even have access to the information that's why this is happening and what is going on. There isn't really a civil society or media or domestic support outside of the leader. But that's one I think that is probably overlooked quite a bit, even by ourselves and by the EU, by the UN in terms of as designing sanctions.
If the goal that's been articulated is not modest, and if it's an unachievable goal, like it seems to be North Korea, and I would suggest Cuba probably is as well, does that not suggest then that the actual target audience for the sanctions is not the target country?
Yeah, it often can be a domestic political message. And so I'm sending a message that I'm taking a hard stand on this. I'm like, I would like them to do this. Great if it happened, but it's probably just as much a message back to your domestic constituency that you're taking a hard stand against that. No, I agree. Over here.
I would say that on the top priority of support with Intel is to consider that it's not just for us, but for other nations, if it's a multilateral sanction effort, because I find a lot of our partners just lack the capacity or capability to have that information. And
right.
We need to have it, and we need to be willing to share it with people. You know, to say that there is a North Korean ship full of coal arriving your port on this day, and you should seize it or turn it around because they just hold it all. And we have to be willing to support them in that effort.
And this is why partnerships with things such as the entire IT industry. And in the banking and finance and credit card industry and all of those are important too, because they play a key role not only in enforcing but also in providing that kind of, can provide that kind of intel about how either these things are being avoided or being implemented. So that's a key element there as well. But thanks for bringing that up.
Are there any consequences to multilateral sanctions when a country decides to pull out and not demonstrate political will? Like, let's say China was to pull out of the sanction that they just participated in.
Or cheat.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, the consequence is that the sanction isn't very effective. Now, can we then sanction that country? Yeah, that's often part of it, is that either if you're not in, you get the secondary sanction. I mean, a multilateral sanction, presumably everybody's on board with the same things, that they all agree to sign up to it. So they will comply. If they don't, then they're going to fall under the secondary sanction of being someone who supports the bad guy. And so there are consequences, yeah. And these consequences can take the shape of, penalties, tariffs, sanctioning them from dealing with us or our companies dealing with them. I mean, so it's basically the same kind of sanction you put on the target country, you put on the secondary as well. So it can come at a big cost. And since those are generally friends to start out with, you know, they really don't like it if you do that. And oftentimes they'll try to adapt, you know, comply with what you want. They may not be very happy, but they'll try to comply. So, yes?
One question, mm-hmm. Just a quick comment on the intel. We've actually, in cases I've dealt with, gotten better at sharing information with our partners. My question is what you mentioned about civil society, et cetera. Where have you seen our public diplomacy message be effective? Like in the cases you've dealt with, where has the public diplomacy message been pretty good? That might be a good example.
I would say that our public diplomacy messages around Myanmar are probably pretty good.
Okay.
In terms of being able to engage. I mean, this is back when I was working with the Nature Conservancy. I was invited to go by the U.S. Embassy to speak in Yangon about civilian action. I don't know how I ever got approved to do that. And I had this great speech with 400 people on the lawn. They couldn't even fit in the room about citizen action, how citizens can take action against and advocate for change in a peaceful way and everything else like that. I personally was involved in one element of many steps that USIA at the time had in terms of getting a public diplomacy message out there about how citizens could support changes that they wanted to have done. And changes, you know, I wasn't allowed to talk about the sanctions per se or anything else, they'd be very careful. But the message was there, sort of giving the idea that people had power to do this. So I would use that as probably an example. I don't know if other folks here who've been involved in them have other examples that they would like to put forward. But I think you have to be able to have, for the public diplomacy efforts within the target country to have effect, you've got to be able to have access to it.
Sure.
And that goes in and out. I mean, Egypt, you know, we get kicked in and out of Egypt on the NGO and support to NGOs quite a bit. So maybe we're touching some raw nerves there. You know, otherwise you wouldn't have those problems happening. But I'd probably put Myanmar on the top of the list for now. Unless you have other ideas.
No, that's what I was
saying. That's a good one, yeah.
Okay.
That's a good question. So yes.
My question is, first of all, back to the slides you showed about the effect of threat. But I'd like to know if there is someone who worked related to the sanction, if there is any some measurement tool or some criteria that whether the sanction is successful or some appropriate choke point or product. So I just want to know what kind of some criteria or what kind of criteria is developed why designing that sort of some considerations.
That's a great question, because one of the key elements is this point here. Make clear the terms for lifting the sanctions. In other words, what's the measure of success? And oftentimes that we've gotten better at that. And we're better at that in bilateral settings than we are in multilateral settings. Because you know how multilateral statements, whether it's the UN or something, they become sort of the lowest common denominator language that everybody will accept. So same things, the measures become somewhat sort of fuzzy, sort of vague as to what the measures are. But that's a really important thing, because we can't measure success. Did they do it? in which case we lift the sanction, unless we know what it is. And if you look at older sanctions, you'll see some of them in many ways were clearer. You know, they must stop doing this, or they must stop doing that. Some of the sanctions more recently are a little more kind of like, we want to see a trend toward this, or they've got to move toward this. And that's harder to measure. Because, well, how far do you want them to move, or how fast do you want them to move? And that's really tough. It's an excellent question, but it's one, as you design a sanction or as you analyze a sanction, the first thing to look for is this. Not just what do they want, but what's the marker? When do I lift the sanction? That's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up. No clear answer. It just, because it depends on the, what it is, the topic, what you want them to do, whether you want them to stop trading in this or whatever. It'll depend on each of those characteristics, but you got to have that measure for so people know that they've met the bar and they can lift a sanction.
I just asked the question because the slide showed with a very clear percentage.
Oh, the threats, yeah. So with, what those did was, success for them was, again, in that case, was they took the, in that case, they took the primary activity being sanctioned, like stop selling arms. And if they stopped, it was considered a success. And if they didn't stop, you know, then it was not. It was either negotiated settlement or stalemate or the senator acquiesced. So that's what they did in that set. In another data set, that like I said, if there were five things they wanted and only one of them happened, they still counted it as a success, even if the other four were a failure. So it's hard to measure those things, but the key is having a clear measure. And both of those have the links on them to the data sets and the analysis, and you can read the summaries, and it'll tell you how they define success. I mean, how they did the measurement to count whether they were, what percentage was successful and what percent was not. And that'll tell you that. But excellent question. Appreciate that.
When we say carrot's more effective than stick, to use a carrot, you have to have a sanction in place. So how often, and how often do you think sanctions are being put in place not to have the immediate impact of a change, but putting a tool in place so that you can use a carrot later on?
And I don't know. That's an interesting question. You can only do that, you know, so often. The other kinds of carrots you can. I mean, when I say use carrots and carrots can also be inducements or things like, you know, adding aid or adding new programs. Not just the lifting of a sanction, but the point is, again, it's use them together, not to have one together. But that's an interesting point. Have we put some out there sort of as straw men so that we can take them off later?
Because I also think it was mentioned over here that I think that wasn't clear at the beginning. I think sanctions are a big part of it. It's kind of like it's punishment. So it's not just I want you to change. I'm going to punish you for something, but now it also gives me the ability down the road to negotiate and lift it as a carrot.
Yeah, I mean, in the trade world, the difference between sanctions and, for instance, trade remedies are, you know, things like countervailing duties and things like that, which are not sanctions. Those are trade remedies. Those are clear punishments. You violated an agreed upon ruling or punished for it. Sanctions are supposed to be a little bit more of the, you've got the option, you've got the choice. This one you've already made the mistake and you're being punished. And this one you're supposed to be given the choice. But you're right, it's a sort of a gray area as you transition from one to the other.
Well, and obviously I was not involved in Canadians, so I wasn't involved in the sanctions on Russia, but I don't think anybody putting sanctions on Russia thinks that's going to change Putin. But I think you do think it's going to punish him in particular things.
Yeah.
And then give you a tool down the road to negotiate with.
Anyone have all the tools out there you possibly can? I think, you know, it's evaluate which ones are going to work and at what domestic cost to you or cost to your partners. And that's the key thing. That's the hard part. Especially in a globalized world, it's really hard to calculate that cost to your partners on all that. So we're actually at time, but anybody have any last minute questions or anything that they want to ask? If not, I am here. You can reach me again all these different ways. Facebook, email, WhatsApp, Viber, all those things. Happy to take questions afterwards as well. And I want to thank you all for the time that you spent here and your interest in this topic. So thank you.